Welcome to Space Midrash, where Jewish thought meets the final frontier. Space being this awe-filled cosmos that's just begging us to come and know it, to be greater through it. And Midrash, the Jewish process of drawing from the past, standing in the present, and creating a narrative richer, more inclusive than our ancestors could have imagined. I'm your host, Jacob Sager, inviting you to join me on this journey, where every episode is an opportunity to expand our understanding, connect across generations, and shape a future that honors our heritage while boldly stepping into the unknown. I believe in an artful humanity, ethically thriving throughout the universe, but we will only become those people if we can tell the story of us becoming those people. Welcome to this special episode of Space Midrash. Today we have an incredible panel of guests joining us. Yifat Pfeffer, Dr. Kathy Larini, Professor Dan Bloomberg, and Yigal Harel. We're going to explore the fascinating world of We Space Technologies, discuss the evolving space economy, and the future of lunar missions. Before we start, I must acknowledge something significant. Most of our guests today are from Israel, and during our conversation, I did not address the profound challenges and the sheer horror their country has faced on and since October 7th. The war and deceit being thrust upon their nation are deeply troubling, and I feel a sincere embarrassment for not recognizing this during our conversation, and an embarrassment for not using this platform to discuss and advocate for Israel on behalf of what's been happening. The resilience and contributions of our guests in such trying times are nothing short of remarkable. We gathered not just to discuss technological advancements, but to ponder the deeper questions that space exploration brings to the fore. Space, much like Jewish history, is a vast expanse filled with both promise and peril. It's a new frontier that challenges our identities, our communities, and our visions for the future. As we explore the technical marvels and entrepreneurial spirit driving space exploration, we also consider the philosophical dimensions of our ventures beyond Earth. How does the pursuit of space reflect our collective dreams and values? What ethical principles should guide us as we reach for the stars? In Jewish thought, the quest is as important as the destination. Our quest to understand the cosmos mirrors our internal quest for meaning and connection. Just as our ancestors wandered through the desert, we now wander through the vastness of space, seeking not only knowledge, but also a sense of belonging and purpose. So join me in this thought-provoking conversation, bridging science, technology, and human ingenuity. Together with the guests, we'll consider the broader implications of our quest to explore and utilize space, reflecting on how these endeavors can shape a more inclusive and hopeful future. Thank you for tuning in. This is Space Midrash, Schmooze with We Space and Guests, Artful Risks, and Lunar Legacies. So we're here on Space Midrash today. We have a special episode where we are gathered with quite the audience today, or quite the group here. We're gathered with Yifat Pfeffer, Dr. Kathy Larini, Professor Dan Bloomberg, pardon me, and Yigal Harel.
Yeah.
That's great. Let's just... quickly, could we go around and just introduce each other and just tell our audience who you are and how you got into space and where you find yourself in the landscape of the space industries and communities? Let's start with Yifat.
Great. Thank you so much for having us. It's a great opportunity. And I'm so thankful for the other participants. Professor Dan and dear Dr. Kathy, I think those both are unicorns. They push so hard, so beautifully, the space dream that we all struggle to make it as a reality soon in our days, as we say. Me and Yigal are the co-founders of We Space Technologies Ltd., which was founded almost 5 years ago with the aim of showing actually how you can make money from the engineering activities on the moon, and to bring those two together and push this lunar economy better than it is when we started. So what we do is actually we manufacture hoppers, lunar hoppers, like the drones on Earth, but we will not be delivering pizza soon, but rather we're retrieving for information and data, as well as deploying equipment, etc. And speak about it later. So I'll shrink my words and make it shorter, otherwise it will be a monologue. So I'm coming from the, I'm a lawyer, my professional. I quit pretty soon after I graduated. I established my other private company called Joy Art Gallery, which is a smart translation methodology to take graphic designs and make the three-dimensional metal art. In WeSpace, I deal with the general management and the business models. And I will now let Yigal take.
Okay, I'm an aerospace engineer. I graduated from the Technion here in Israel. I spent 21 years at the defense companies here in Israel, managing development of systems for mainly for the Air Force. And after this, I joined SpaceRail, which was a non-for-profit organization, which runs the Bereshit program. I led the entire program, working with IAI, Israeli Aerospace Industries, and SpaceX, and all the subcontractors that support us in bringing the first Israeli lunar lander to the moon. We succeeded to capture by the moon, but landing was not so easy to land on the moon as we saw after it. But still, we are very proud from what we did. And after it, with the fact I established WeSpace to go back to the moon and to explore it and to find waters and other minerals and do the good thing.
Thank you. You go. Dr. Larini.
Yeah, so my name is Kathy Larini. I am an engineer as well. I worked for NASA for about 35 years, retired about 5 years ago. And now I work for a company called Leidos in their Dynetics division. So Leidos is a big aerospace and other services company, about 46,000 employees. My NASA career was always spent in human spaceflight, space shuttle program, space station program, in various engineering and program management roles. The last 10 years of my career, though, were spent in a more of a strategic planning role, helping prepare NASA's plan to go back to the moon and on to Mars. And it's exciting for me because I was 9 when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon. And that's one of the reasons why I pursued a space career and have loved every minute of it and all the contributions I've been able to make. So helping plan this next journey that NASA now is implementing as the Moon to Mars initiative is something I'm extremely proud of. And with Leidos, I do various things, including serving as a teammate to WeSpace in realizing this family of hoppers.
Thank you very much. Dr. Bloomberg.
First of all, thank you for inviting me here. I want to congratulate you on having a podcast on space issues, space and philosophy. If you look at any mythology, space is a big part of all mythologies and all philosophies. By the way, including the Jewish one. I'm at the moment, I'm a professor at Ben Gurion, University of the Negev in Be'er Sheva, Israel. I am a vice president at the university, and I'm chairman of the Israel Space Agency. So first of all, I figured out from what Kathy just said that we're the same age because I experienced Neil Armstrong at the exact same age. Figured that one out. That wasn't very difficult to get. But later on in my adulthood, I won't go into the entire story, but I was studying the interaction between climate and geology. And the person that ended up being my PhD advisor decided to come and visit in Israel and interview me for a PhD position. Professor Ronald Greeley from Arizona State University. He was one of the people that trained the original lunar astronaut early on in his career. And he offered me to come and work on a radar mission, actually, on the space shuttle. Had nothing to do with the rest of the planet. So I used to joke and say, at least I know that Earth is one of the planets and we live in space here, even on Earth. And I was studying the use of space-borne radar to understand wind-blown processes, initially on Earth, and then also on Venus and Mars, and got more and more into remote sensing, using this data to understand long-term processes, understand the comparison between Earth and other planets. And here I am, still working on space issues, heading the Israel Space Agency, and I want to say a word over there on the space agency. Israel was the eighth nation in the world to reach space, full capabilities in space, back in 1988. So I think that we're doing a lot of things in that area here in space, and we'll probably talk about some of them as we move along.
Yes. So Dr. Blumberg, I have a question for you specifically, which is, having studied at Arizona State University and being a leader and administrator and professor at Ben-Gurion University, and also studying other planets and their weather patterns, I'm curious, Arizona, Phoenix, that whole area is an inhospitable environment that in the last 200 years has been changed into
hell on earth.
Huge metroplexes, very similar to Beersheba and to the Negev, has transformed. So I'm curious what your thoughts are about how possibly those communities, both in how they're directly related academically to studying and supporting space and planetary science, but possibly the human settlements that are there that have grown in the last 200 years from really nothing, how that might be related to the human pursuit in space.
So there are many ways I could answer this question. One question would be why actually space sciences has developed at ASU, at BGU, and there are a few other places that I could mention. I think that the first thing that comes to mind is that we live in desert here. If you look at Mars, Mars is a huge desert. Mars has wind-blown processes, has dunes. You look at Venus. Venus is not only a desert, but it's a hot desert, a very hot desert. And there are a lot of analogies between these environments. And understanding what happens on those planets will actually help us better understand what happens on Earth and what might happen as climate changes, as climate gets warmer. So I think that there's certain similarities, and being able to do field work in your backyard is one of the things that actually pushes space sciences forward at BGU and at ASU and a few other places that I could mention easily.
That's one of the reasons why working in space is particularly rewarding, I think, is because the challenges that you have to overcome to send people beyond Earth into space, they have to be able to survive in extreme environments. So the technology investments, things like water processing and closed loop life support system, high temperature materials and mechanisms, you're going to see those kinds of investments. We already are. NASA's already spinning off a lot of those technologies, but you'll see them more important as extreme environments become more populated and environments become more extreme.
I think that if I go on from what Kathy just added, if you look at Michigan, Raycor, Michigan has been studied using remote sensing a hell of a lot, mainly agriculture. That's not the environment you're going to find on the moon or on Mars or on Venus. But if you look at the Algodones Dunes in Southern California or the Mojave Desert, there are a lot of similarities between the Mojave Desert and what on Mars. If you look at the volcanic field in the Mojave, a lot of similarities. Go up to Idaho, you'll see craters of the moon have a lot of similarities to the lunar surface. And those are challenges you want to deal with. And as Kathy said, the technology is what enabled the population to grow in Phoenix or in Beersheba. You think of Phoenix without air conditioning. Boy, you don't want to be living there. But AC changed it all.
It's a good business to be in out there. I have a question for Dr. Larini about business and your career in leadership and strategic planning and your career in a big established company working with a newer business like WeSpace. My question is, in the new space economy, which can be a buzzword that a lot of people throw out a lot and some people avoid, but in the new space economy, how has the relationship shifted between academic, industry, the bigger aerospace partners, the smaller startups or innovative teams, as well as, I know defense plays a part in all of that as well. And I'm curious from your perspective, how that's shifted and what is exciting now at the space you get to stand at.
Yeah, there have been a lot of changes, I would say, in the last 15 years, and they're all, from my perspective, really good. And the pendulum has swung really from a phase when governments funded everything, set all the requirements, managed all the risk, and to a point where new space, if you will, or startup companies are coming with their own new ideas and new ideas about how to do things better and more efficiently and cheaper. And so what the merging of the cultures, let's say one of not willing to take much risk, which costs a lot of money, to with the cultures that are embrace the risk and can rapidly test solutions or risk mitigations. The companies like WeSpace have closer connections, oftentimes have closer connections to academia, right? They can leverage a lot of different solutions that are being thought of now by the younger folks looking way to the future. So it has been a big change. I think what, from my perspective, having grown up in the world where things were done very without wanting to take much risk and therefore very expensive. I worked on programs that lasted an awfully long time. Yigal talked about Beresheet, I think, from the time they really started with detailed design till the time they landed on the moon was probably just a handful of years compared to what it took to realize a space station, which I worked on the development of that for 20 years. So if we want to keep moving forward, we have to adopt these new ways of doing this. We have to be willing to take more risk, but we have to be able to take smart risks. We have to understand the risk that we're taking, I think. And that's where I think the cultures working together can help each other. I see a lot of new space companies that they embrace the risk, we'll take the risk, but they don't really understand how much risk they are taking. And I think I've seen some of these lunar landers over the last several years that have had issues. They either, in some cases, they didn't understand how big of a challenge a certain thing was or how much risk a certain choice of a part, certain lower quality part would bring. And as a result, you know, what happened? And so there's a benefit of merging the two cultures that definitely, I think, as we go forward, is one of the reasons why there's so much new investment in space, so much new activity in space, so many things that are happening, right? Because a lot of knowledge has been gained, but a lot of new ideas and creative solutions are being brought to the table. Who would have thought of 3D printing a rocket? Things that are happening now are really exciting. It's all good.
I think that if you also look at what it took to put something in space years ago was a fortune. Only governments had that kind of funding. And there was no reason for a private company, a private enterprise to do that unless it was paid by a government. And what's happened in the past few years is that we see all the opportunities that are there and the huge opportunity. If you think of the GPS that was developed for military uses, not for us to use Waze and Google Maps, that suddenly showed how you can use it in your daily life. All our watches now use the clocks that are on the GPS satellite. Communications are now being done by private companies. Just look at Starlink, at what the opportunity is over there. I think there are a lot of opportunities out.
And WeSpace,
when we talk about...
When they came to us first... I'm sorry, one last thing. When WeSpace came to us with this idea of a lunar hopper, we could immediately envision some applications for it, but they had many more ideas than we had even thought about. And that's just an example of when you're motivated, when you have different motivations, a lot of innovation happens.
And by the way, think of the challenges that you asked about earlier. We space are going to the most hostile environment for a hopper, solving the challenge of moving on the moon. It'll be much easier for them in the future to do that on Earth.
So that brings me to my next question, which is for Igal. We talk about how the industry changes or how the technology emerges and changes in these different generations of spaceflight or these just new opportunities and markets. How have the challenges of lunar missions evolved with technology? And are they becoming easier or more routine?
Look, I think that the technology that is being developed to space orbiting Earth is so mature now, so we can use most of the subsystems that is as the high TRL, TRL-9, and use it on the moon as well. With some adaptation, because the temperature is different, But most of the system can be used well.
TR-9, that's technology readiness, right?
Yeah, the highest technology. It's actually been tested, been in service. Actually, it's the highest level of readiness. And this is give us a lot of power because it's reduced the risk and reduced the cost and reduced the time depth. So technology has been all the time being improved and very quickly. And due to the fact that the access to orbiting the moon is so easy now, thanks to mainly to SpaceX, the development is very quick and promising.
My next question is for Ifat, which is, you say you also have an art gallery where you take graphic designs and represent them in a three-dimensional plane, which I think is very interesting. I've seen some of your metal art before. I'm curious, what's the intersection of art and space technology? Is there any relationship there to creating things out of metal and creating robots?
It's a great question, and you're the first one to ask. That's what I liked in those questions you sent us, just to get into your mood. Will probably take much more than just in one or two podcasts, but then try to make it shorter. It's the same question I asked myself when I quit the law firm I worked in and started my own first business as an entrepreneur. I asked, do I need a previous knowledge in order to do it right? And what I learned also in space, especially in space, that the most important thing is to come open-minded. You need to come very simple, open-minded, not restricted to any previous all kinds of restrictions. I'll tell you one example. When we started this space opportunity, which was shortly after the launch of Bereshit 1, me and Igal, we were couples then. We were partners in life too. So it was layers by layers of struggles. Chapter 2 for both of us. Each one brought his kids. We had 7 together. And we had this dream to make something new, innovative, that will also keep on going the Israeli legacy in space after Bereshit. So we kept on thinking what is most needed. And as I also asked the NASA guys, how come we haven't seen hoppers till now? And I said, one guy said to me this, look, human beings, when they confront struggle, a problem, they tend to go to the near place where they have their working tools. Go to the basement, you look what you got there, and if you can use them and leverage them. And so we got to those rovers. Got a lot of money there in the automotive industry. Got a lot of know-how, and we have been thinking about a meter. But this was done by going through some kind of a maintenance. It was not very innovative. So we started with a rover, and when we came to the hoppers and the main struggle of the moon, which is lack of information, lack of data, when we reached with that rover to the first pit, you reach a pit and then you say, okay, what do I do now? This rover, I throw it down there, but what if it's blocked? Since then, I started to realize that you mustn't go with the model of Me Too. You need to understand the problems much deeper and not be afraid of asking questions and thinking different than the others, like I did in the art business as well. I brought machineries. I brought a lot of technology into that process. So one day I remember me and Eagle and asking, what the hell do we need to go down on wheels and struggle with that regolite and being worried, what if the regolite touches the lenses? And what about those sharp rocks? How can we move on this terrain? And then we ask, why should we? Anyhow, why cannot we, like a bird, look at it from far, upper than on the wheels, and collect information, collect the data, and have some kind of a lunar Google, or Google map of the moon. So we started thinking like the others, struggling and understanding that the first need of the moon is not that vehicle, but the information and the data, and then reaching the conclusion that the first vehicle to be deployed off the lander should be a hopper. It will scan all the places, go down to pits, tubes, craters. And when we have this information, then we can tell the other guys, go here, don't go there. It's very valuable information. So this way of way that we did was showing that, first of all, don't be frightened to think differently, as I did with the art, as we do with the space. We have a lot of troubles when you think differently. For instance, when you show your deck, your presentation to investors, you sometimes need to speak differently. I'll give you an instance. Most of the companies that develop vehicles to the moon are talking about the length of the duration of the mission, the energy, the power to ignite and work with the vehicles is one of the main factors. What would you do when you're out of fuel? It took you so much money and time to reach the moon. What do you do now? So everybody's tries to show that the rover is a perfect solution because it works endlessly, theoretically, right? Because it goes by the solar panels and there's so much sun there. But when we speak about the hopper, our mission duration is much shorter because we bring our fuel from Earth. We bring our rocket propellant and for 70 wet mass of a hopper, we can only scan for 20 minutes. But then in a certain minute, you understand that it's not the mission duration. It's the area coverage. It's what you succeed doing in this duration. If a rover conducts 0.0 square kilometers for those 15 minutes, our hopper can do 17 square kilometers. So you change the language and you start to speak differently. It's not, and you tell the guys, and you need to be very polite, and it's not the mission duration. It's what you retrieve during that time. You bring new ideas. It's a new vehicle. It's a new story. But we think this is the most important thing that the moon, the lunar economy needs. Bring the map. Look what happens, how difficult it is to land, how difficult it is to deploy your Indian rover and realize after a few meters that there is something that stops you from continuing, and then you have to go all the way back. The right order should be hoppers collecting data, selling that data to everyone, showing the rovers where to go, and saving a lot of money and time.
Let me expand this to the question for the group, which is, so you talk about the hoppers being this part of the lunar economy of selling the information, the mapping to, I'm guessing, to other companies that want to be on the moon and putting their crafts there. What is the shape of the lunar economy that's going to be taking place? It seems, from somebody who I recently got turned back on to the space economy, once Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin started sending up those small passengers, and that turned me back on to the fact that we had 600 people in space previously, but sometime soon we'll be sending 600 people a year into space. And then, as I continue to learn about companies like yours, is that a lot of industry and a lot of nations are very interested in the moon right now. And some of the terms that have come up and that I've learned about is that we have not just the moon, but we have the whole cislunar economy, the way that space, Earth's space and the moon's space will work for human endeavors beyond that sphere. So I'm curious, what's the shape that the lunar economy, beyond just information as a service from one technology provider to another, what shape is that going to be taking place? And what's the time frame on how that takes place?
I think that we need to think of the moon in a few ways. And one of the most important ones is as a resource, both a resource for exploration. So there's a lot of talk now building a base on the moon to go from there to Mars. But the other issue is a resource for bringing back minerals to Earth. A third area could be for communication on Earth. That's a base where you could place additional instruments. And I'm sure there are a lot of elements of the economy that we cannot even imagine at the moment. But it's getting a little easier to get to, the moon. And there's more discussion of doing collaboration and building things on the moon as a platform to serve us here on Earth, or serve us to go to other places and explore other places.
I think the moon will be another Earth eventually, because the mankind will never stop. And later on, it will go all the way pushed to Mars because the curiosity. So everything will be the same as soon as you have a good enough mobility. If Mars succeeds and he brings these 150, 200 tons soon, then everything opens up. And you'll go for your vacation to the moon. It's just 3 days away if you can resist those conditions in the spacecraft and the rocket.
From a Jewish ethical or philosophical perspective, what principles do you think should guide humanity's approach to space exploration and potential human migration into space?
I'll take a first stab at that. I think that an important element in Jewish tradition is environmental protection. If you think of almost all the holidays, they have an element of environmental protection. Think of the fact that you're not allowed to use certain fields once every 7 years and so on, to protect the environment, to protect the soil. Think that from a Jewish perspective, the most important thing is that whatever we do on the moon cannot harm the environment, and we have to be aware of the impact of what we're doing there.
What's exactly should be Jewish about it or not? Probably yes, but I think there's much more than just that. It said that Israel is one of the most talented country that produces IPs like so fast, relatively. Is it the Jewish genes? Is it the mothers? Is it the struggles here with the existence? I don't know, maybe. But I'm not sure I would emphasize that 100%. I would just say that, and it goes as double when you speak about the Holocaust that we recently mentioned. The feeling that you need to take care of the next generations. the fact that you cannot live in peace and quiet because it's a hostile environment, no matter what year it is. And look what's happening now. Well, sure, that brings you to the conclusion that we're done here. We should go fast to the moon. We should do everything from the start. Looks so bad. So if you're looking at the next generations and you think of your legacy and what's your liability, there are tons of reservoirs there at the moon. And you need to put your hands there and bring it or use it there and see what happens when there are wars like Ukraine. The world is going crazy. Prices are so high. Everything, transportation, the wheat, everything. So you start to feel insecure and you're looking for extras. What do you have that you can take and bring some more? And as an overall problem, how are you going to feed everyone when the population is getting so big? And probably there will not be enough for everyone. So I'm not sure it's Jewish. Maybe not, maybe just partially, but ethical and philosophy issues here are you came to life not just to eat and have fun and have your wine. I mean, you have something to do with your next generation. Do something important, okay? If you can, use it and do it. That's what I personally think.
Question that just came to mind is from an American perspective, very much because of the Apollo days and just the realities of using satellites as part of the defense infrastructure, is from the American perspective, we see a lot of space and space opportunities as being at contentious ends with Russia and with China and their goals, which may not necessarily be the same kind of free world goals that we have. I'm curious from an Israeli perspective, being in a different place diplomatically and being in a different place as the startup nation in the different industries that make up the space industries all over the world, if there's an opportunity for Israel in the space age and on the moon or beyond planet Earth to have an interesting impact on international relationships.
I'll take that one. First of all, you spoke about the defense issue. Obviously, space is an important place to be, to use in order to look at your the areas around you, and that's for defense reasons, environmental issues, and so on. But the ability to go to space and the ability to work with other nations is extremely important for Israel to showcase its capabilities and technology. Think of the Hopper, wheat space and the Hopper. Leidos is not interested in it because it's Israeli. It's interested because of the technology, because it's an enabler for LIDAR. It'll be an enabler for other companies also. As much as we can showcase our technologies and work with companies like LIDAR, LIDAR will be coming back to look at other technologies also in Israel. So it's a showcase of our abilities. It's also an issue of collaboration. We have collaboration with other nations, Italy, for example. We have a joint satellite with France, the Venus satellite, which allowed our engineers and our scientists to work with colleagues in other countries and show that Israel is not only about war, but also doing a lot of science and good science, which gets published in top-notch journals. So it is an enabler. We're also looking at collaboration. We had a joint call with the UAE, and several projects came out of that. We're looking at other collaborations with the UAE. We have certain collaborations with other countries, Arab countries that are often thought of in the geopolitical context of the environment that we're in, thought of as enemies, but we can work with them in space. So I think that space becomes an enabler also for peace, for sharing ideas, for talking, for this discussing not only our geopolitical problem.
I very much agree with that. Look at the cooperation in space between the United States and Russia during the Cold War. There was scientific collaboration exchange. There were Apollo Soyuz test flight missions. It built a strong respect for each other's capabilities and a strong realization between both countries that space is really a resource that supports mankind and not just country boundaries. You look at the Earth from space and you don't see lines dividing countries, weather patterns that affect multiple people, communications cones that service multiple countries. So it's a great space, is a great place to collaborate and build international relationships.
I think that one of the most exciting pictures from space is the first picture of one of the Apollo missions coming up behind the moon and looking at Earth rising in the horizon over there. And you suddenly realize that, okay, we're only one planet in a huge cosmos. And in order to be able to work in space, we have to collaborate. It's an expensive endeavor, a touristy environment. A space station wouldn't be built by one nation only. It was a collaboration of nations. And by the way, it's also fun sharing ideas, and a lot of creativity comes from multicultural collaborations. And here in Israel, we understand that we want to be able to talk to our neighbors. We want to be able to talk not only about the war going on in Gaza, but also about building another little satellite between students, sharing ideas, or using the Hopper to get new data about the moon and having students from Israel, the US, India, and Saudi Arabia working together on the data that'll come back from the We Space mission.
Beaker is a great project that the US leads now, called Artemis. This is a great endeavor. This really shows the beauty of human collaborations. And we are one, We Space is one of the candidates to be considered as the Israeli contribution for the Artemis project, meaning that Israel will donate a hopper to that project. And we are designing a mission with NASA, Ames, negotiations. Nothing is done yet, but it's moving on very nicely. They're doing a great job. Very serious persons there. And I think it's going to be a huge news. And Professor Dani is a great supporter. I think he's the one to receive the thank you. And maybe if it fails, I'll send to you also, Dani. Can you take that?
Success has many years. Failure.
Yeah. And of course, Kathy. Kathy pushed that further and further with all these struggles, the bureaucracy of the US. And we got together in a very nice agreement, and we are partners. So we can see different nations, different people, different genders, different perspectives, lawyers, engineers, whatever. When you get together and you get those different minds, different perspectives, you can just be much more clever. And turned out that when you talk about hatred and enemies and countries that do not get together well, it turned out that when you have big interests, it overcomes the hatred. There is a major force called interests. And that's fine, as long as it reaches the right results. So Artemis is a beautiful project.
I'll take that issue of Artemis. Artemis has two elements. One is the Artemis Accords, and one is the Artemis mission. The Artemis Accords talk about collaboration and protection of the space, working together between nations. The Artemis mission is aimed at the moment at going back to the moon. Was a much bigger challenge than it was during Apollo, much bigger rocket, being able to build a base on the moon. And some of the challenges are related to the hostile environment, having astronauts sitting on the moon for quite a while. So during the first mission, Artemis 1, Israel had a joint project with Germany and the US, where two mannequins, two dolls, were on the mission. One named Helga, German, one named Zohar. Both were instrumented with a lot of instruments measuring radiation. The difference being that on Zohar, we had an Israeli vest, radiation vest, a very lightweight vest that could protect Zohar. And we measured together with the German if that actually protects the astronaut, that will protect them in the future. By the way, the answer is yes, but the papers are going to come out in the near future. But I think that the most important point that I wanted to make over there is last week, we marked the Holocaust Day. 80 years ago, who would have thought that Israel and Germany would be collaborating on a mission to protect human life in space? The WeSpace Hopper, maybe in the future, will be a joint mission with the UAE, Saudi Arabia, the US, looking at the lava tubes on the moon.
We talk about... Please, you can go.
Okay.
I was going to say you could go, but so I'll just take to the next question, which is Artemis going back to the moon. Dr. Bloomberg and Dr. Larini, you talked about the Apollo 11 experience as a young person deeply inspiring you. And I'm wondering, what moment do you think needs to take place now that could inspire? You're all industry folk, plenty of people outside, to inspire more people to get that this is really happening, that this economy is on, that you have multiple nations who are working very hard at these greater things that might not necessarily be visually realized at this moment, but are coming about.
From my perspective, there's a lot of exciting plans as NASA tests out the Artemis hardware. NASA and its international partners test out the Artemis hardware, sending people around the moon, landing people on the moon again. It's been over 50 years since that happened. Getting the many people on this earth were not alive then. There's people who probably still think the moon landings were faked. So I think it'll be exciting once again to see people on the moon, see some of these robotic landers continue to land safely. And I think it will be important to realize that unlike Apollo, where the goal of Apollo was to get men on the moon and beat the Russians in doing so, the goal of Artemis is to get humanity to go back to the moon in a sustained way. So the hardware that's being designed will enable people to test out all sorts of different concepts, do all sorts of different science, unlike the Apollo, which was specifically designed to get there fast and first. So this new set of systems and partnerships, so much more to be done. And with so many different ideas about what can be done on and around the moon in cislunar space, as you said, there'll be a lot of exciting activities, discoveries. And my perspective is it'll just keep raising interest and multiplying the effects.
Think of on the Apollo mission, one of the cool things that I remember is the two astronauts running and singing as they bounced on the moon. I don't even remember what it was, some children's song, as they were bouncing on the moon. Think of astronauts going back to the moon, throwing their food on the moon, or playing a basketball game on the moon, and talking on the cell phone with the kids, using new
right. It'll land different in the age of TikTok.
Yeah,
definitely.
Do some TikTok things on the moon.
I want to ask a roundtable question kind of to wrap up here. If you were to go to space, what would you bring with you? Whether you were just going to the International Space Station or the moon or beyond, it can be your choice in this thought experiment. But I ask all my guests this question.
As we did in Beresheet, we would always take our flag. First, always.
I would take a picture of my children because that reminds me why I do this, to make the world a better place for them.
So I'll answer on the less serious the note at the end. I'll take with me a return ticket.
Okay.
A copy of this. Number two, that concerto. I'll take my classical music, but just kidding. That's a nice question. Children is a one important idea. Flags and everything, but can we bring some news there? Can we take something different? Can we convey a new message to as a newcomers to the moon? I don't know. We have to think of that, but we should for sure make it a better place. Okay. I think that's what's going on now everywhere. with the anti-Semitism, with the caliphate ideas. People are going crazy. I think most of us are bored. All those are that are feeling very bored. Come to the moon. There's so much to do there. You're going to be so occupied. You're going to forget how is it to hate someone else.
So I think that if I win now, and I think that timing is, everything is about timing. I'd have this listening. It's just bring them home now.
Yeah. We're waiting for hostages. Who could believe?
So I'll also wrap up the recording here. Love to do it again. I definitely have more questions I know I didn't even get to in the course of our hour together. Sure. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you, Ifat, in particular, for I reached out to you and you invited everyone else here. Thank you, Igal. Thank you, Dr. Bloomberg. Thank you, Dr. Larini. I'm forever grateful.
Thank you very much for the chance to participate today. Jacob, thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you, Dr. Larini.
Interesting set of questions.
Effie, cheers.
Mazal tov.
Be well.
Happy birthday.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Jacob. Okay,
thank you.
Well, and we are here gladly to be again with you.
This episode of Space Midrash was produced by me, Jacob Sager, right here on Planet Earth 2024.